Here we are, episode 56. We looked at Fallout this week from Amazon Prime. And the last thing I watched from Amazon Prime, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, I basically commented that Amazon basically get it wrong all the time, other than the boys. But I really enjoyed Fallout, so I'll maybe give them the benefit of the doubt for the next 6 months at least. What did you think?
Well, we're back to video game adaptations territory, aren't we? Obviously, we had Last of Us at the beginning of last year. Is that right?
The Witcher's been ongoing.
There's tons. And I think it's like something that's rising in popularity. I've heard rumours of all kinds of things in the pipeline. PlayStation trying to basically churn out all of its IPs into a TV series and movies or whatever. Historically, pretty hit and miss. But, I mean, you know, with the success of The Last of Us last year, I think maybe it's something that's on the rise. I know that video games sort of tend to tell really good stories, but they kind of get underappreciated because of the general perception on that.
Of being a gamer.
Of being a game, I guess. Yeah. Of being, I think the general consensus on video games as a medium being slightly less respected than even movies and TV. Of course, this is like lowbrow entertainment versus, you know, a novel or a poem or whatever, even a short story. So essentially what I mean is it's more lowbrow in terms of literature. That said, though, I think, you know, a lot of the time video games do tell a really, really good story. Have really interesting themes and all the rest, and they don't really get brought to light because you have to sort of play the game, and if you're not a gamer, obviously you're sort of that the story is impenetrable to you.
Yeah.
So I guess it makes sense that we're seeing adaptations.
The adaptation of games seem to have stories that push social norms and boundaries a little bit more than your average cop drama or, as I've put it, big network show, basically.
Okay.
And, you know, I kind of was thinking, okay, why is that? And why are they safe to do so? You know, it's hot property right now, adapting a game into a show or a film. And I'm just thinking maybe it's because there's a committed fan base, they're obviously going to watch the show.
Yeah.
So you're allowed to tell the story that's written in the game that's maybe a little bit more on the nose.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, we think of last week in Three Body Problem, the writer having to put the bit about the revolution in the middle because they wouldn't get the first book published.
Game
adaptations don't have that problem because there's already a dedicated fan base. There's already people that love the story, and transforming it into a show, you know, you've got people there that are ready to watch.
Yeah. I think video games have historically been steeped in controversy as well. The stories that that video game developers have tried to tell, or the themes that they've tried to include, you know, like, and of course, again, the medium being stigmatized, I guess, historically, and probably still to an extent now, although admittedly less so. The one that comes to mind straight away is the hot coffee incident in GTA, or the or No Russian in that Call of Duty campaign. You know, these moments in video game history where the public has kind of like been outraged, and developers been forced to recall games or alter the content on a disc or whatever. And I find it really interesting because, of course, it's bizarre that it seems to be targeted at video games as a medium. Because if you had the same scene, if you had that No Russian scene, or I mean, with the hot coffee incident, it is a simple sex scene, you know? And like, if you had that in a movie at the same time, okay, fine, there might have been a little bit of, you know, criticism, but there wouldn't have been the same, like, political outrage, because it really was. I mean, Hillary Clinton got involved in the hot coffee thing. But yeah, I mean, I guess we're now seeing this move where we're lifting themes and stories from video games and putting them on screen because, as you say, it makes it more socially acceptable to tell them in this medium. I mean, we spoke last year about whether The Last of Us should potentially have always been a TV series rather than a video game. because ultimately it's so story focused.
Mm.
The story is so strong.
Yeah.
It almost makes sense as a TV series more than it does a video game. Like, why make it interactive?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it's worked for Fallout, I guess. I didn't play it, so I don't know.
Yeah. I've played Fallout a little bit. What you were talking about there is kind of dotted a few, crossed a few T's and dotted a few I's for me. I feel right. A little bit, I personally feel a little bit disappointed with the game industry as it is right now. I don't think we're getting new, fun, exciting stories. And I wonder if the focus is being taken away from creating something new and, off the chart and kind of never been seen before in the industry. And these game developers are realizing, hang on, there's money in turning our old stuff into movies and TV shows here.
Yeah, that probably is true to an extent. I mean, I imagine the video game developers, the people doing the coding, etc., like the actual game developers, probably aren't that involved.
Mm.
Although the people selling the IPs or the story editors, the writers, I mean, maybe they are the same people. Maybe they're being bought over from the projects or whatever. I'm not sure. But I guess that's ultimately a conversation about the gaming industry. And I mean, I know that the indie game world is kind of thriving.
Mm,
I don't even have Steam, but apparently that's huge. Yeah. There's like an enormous library of games on there that, and AAA is kind of falling apart.
Yeah.
I guess you're definitely onto something, but that's a conversation about the industry.
Yeah.
One
thing I've always thought is, do you think an actor has to be a gamer to play one of these roles? Do you think it's one of their active interests to take up a role like this? Because you see Pedro Pascal do Joel, and you see Ryan Reynolds do Pikachu, Detective Pikachu.
What?
And you think, yeah.
Right?
And I wonder if, when you see this script laid down, do you only take it on because you're a gamer, or do you think it's just more work? It's work for the actors and they just take it on?
I guess it's the latter.
It's got to be your interest.
I don't think it necessarily has to. I imagine it helps. I'm sure writers jump at the opportunity to do stuff. I mean, we've seen that. Who plays Jack Reacher? Got Alan Ritchie? Alan Richards? Whatever, I don't care. Fuck it. Well, he's recently been quite vocal about wanting to play Batman. He's like, I love Batman. I want to be Batman. Like, whatever. Tom Holland did the remake of, or the adaptation of the Uncharted series as Nathan Drake.
Yeah.
Again, I've never played them and never seen them, so I don't know anything about it. But I know that he came out and was like, yeah, they were like my favourite games, so I really wanted to be involved in that. So I guess it helps for sure. But, how many actors do you think read the novel of a movie that they're adapting? It's the same thing, isn't it? I imagine the majority try to, at least, or have a really thorough understanding of the story at the very least, but I think probably more than you'd like to think, just do the spark notes. Michael Gambon, Michael Gambon never read Harry Potter. Dumbledore without reading them, and I think to this day he died without having read them. And it frankly, it shows. His portrayal of Dumbledore is a car crash. I might get some smoke for that, but honestly, I'm ready for it. Can't bear it. Total absolute disgrace on what that character is supposed to be. But anyway, Fallout.
Yes, Fallout. Ella Purnell from Yellow Jackets,
Jackie.
Really interesting. Now, I mean, it didn't take me long to realise that that it was her. So a good few years for Ella Purnell, and she's pretty good. She's amazing.
Well, it's funny because it's a very similar role, isn't it? If you think about it, like, obviously the genres are, well, different for the most part, in that you could argue Fallout is sci-fi, whatever. I mean, it's similar in the sense that her role is a naive but intelligent young woman who is forced into a really bleak and almost inhuman environment.
Yes.
And so there's a similarity there for sure. You see this kind of like, happy-go-lucky, almost, but very able young person just go through absolute trauma. The tone is different, though, of course, because like Fallout really holds on to the kind of like the comedy, I guess.
Yeah.
There's a really light-hearted approach to some to the themes involved.
Yeah.
That's very present in the games.
Yeah.
You can tell that radiates off them just from the little like cartoon man, the vault boy,
yeah,
or whatever the mascot, whatever of the pit boy on the wrist. And I know it's like all over the marketing of the game is like this little cartoon guy, and like him being a representation of a post nuclear world, like a post nuclear war. That there's, you know, Earth is a devastated wasteland, and this little like
don't smile. Lose your head.
Yeah, exactly. Like the balance of tone and context is, you know, like it really brings out a comedy. Fallout stories lent into that, and the show takes that up, and it works really well. You know, it's there throughout. I mean, taking off the guy's head, the scientist. Of course, part of the show is that the scientist has injected himself with essentially the solution for cold fusion.
Yeah.
And he dies, but he's like, well, you're gonna have to cut my head off, because if you take my head, you can save humanity. I mean, you know, like, and she's like, oh, okay, and just sort of grits the teeth okey and does dokey. It like okie dokie, exactly. Yeah, it's the light-hearted spin on what many other shows would take a different approach to.
It's interesting, because my suspicious side comes out when you really, you've made it quite clear that there was, it looked like there was some talent scouting for Ella Purnell there. They've seen her in Yellow Jackets, played that role, and have recruited her for a similar-ish kind of role in this. Because I was going to talk about Walter Goggins, who plays Cooper, and the last time I saw him, he was in The Hateful Eight, playing the same character.
Except, do you think?
Well, same-ish character. I mean, and
Western Gunslinger, I'll give you that.
Yeah, Western Gunslinger, and The Hateful Eight is excellent. And Walter Goggins is, well, I think The Hateful Eight is excellent. I think it's maybe branded one of Quentin Tarantino's weaker films, but
I think it's
probably
best.
One of my favourites. Yeah. But here we've got Walter Goggins playing a ghoul, and Cooper Howard, and, you know, another excellent performance. But, you know, as I said, talent ID for Ella Purnell playing that character, and I think a bit of talent ID for Walter Goggins here.
Yeah, of course, but I don't know why you sort of put a negative spin on that. It's like you've figured out how casting works, and you're being like, I see a conspiracy here. Like, that's just how it works.
No, I get it. Like, you know, I want to see those characters. If I loved them in a previous role, I'd love to see them play something similar in a different one. But at the same time, you know, I want to defend against characters being pigeonholed. Like, I wouldn't want to see Ella Purnell and Walter Goggins do this role in something else again for the third time. That's what I'm trying to say. Like, I'm always worried about getting character or actors being pigeonholed and things like
that. Maybe that's what they want. Maybe they only want to play one role. I don't think everyone's out trying to, like, really portray...
Have a diverse...
Like, yeah, really, like, flex their range and be like, I can do anything. I can be... You know, like, because ultimately, no one really can. Think of, like, the likes of Matthew McConaughey or Leonardo DiCaprio, just, like, off the top of my head, two major Hollywood actors. Like, okay, fine, there's a lot of diversity there. But ultimately, like, you're casting them for particular roles, aren't you? You're casting them for big, quite hyper-masculine roles, generally. Yeah. Okay? I mean, fine, I'm sure there's exceptions, but maybe those two are bad examples. I don't think they are, whatever. The point is, I think you always, to an extent, are going to be...
This person's not, good for this.
Yeah, not pigeonholed, but you're going to have the type of roles that you generally play.
Mm.
And having the odd kind of break from your routine style, and like, that's cool, that shows your range, but like, you know, I don't think there's many actors out there who are literally just trying to do anything. Like, every, like, you know, like, yeah, you can't predict their next move, sort of thing.
Yeah, I guess that's just my I guess I just think that's what everyone wants, but there we go. I don't really have much bad to say about it. Do you have any criticisms that you found? You know, anything? I'm feeling like I really stayed away from any kind of reaction to to kind of influence my decision. I just really enjoyed this. I've got one hole, but anything you found that you've kind of got a bit of a problem with?
Not really, not in terms of the storytelling. Really enjoyed it. I know it's not the plot of either of the games. It's kind of, I believe it's like Fallout 3 and Fallout 4 kind of merged. That's where they got the sort of story idea from. My one minor criticism, I guess, would be like, the story is a bit all over the place. And I also, actually, not to derail this, but I wasn't a fan of Maximus.
Okay.
The character or the actor, actually. I thought he was kind of trash. Aspirant Maximus, played by Aaron Moten. I mean, he just wasn't convincing. He was kind of... He felt really flat.
Yeah.
I wasn't really invested in him at all. And also, it didn't help that he was sort of, like, so morally dubious. And that seemed to come up very, very quickly as well. The whole knife in his mate's boot to wound them and then steal their place as a squire, you know, after his friend gets promoted and he doesn't. You're led to believe that Maximus planted the knife, but of course that's not what happened. His friend planted the knife themselves because, I don't know, they were nervous or something, I don't know. But the thing is, then very shortly after that, you see Maximus genuinely start to do really, really questionable things, like letting the knight he's supposed to be serving die. Because he's a bit of a dick. I mean, that's quite an extreme, you know. And of course at this time you still believe that he's planted the knife to wound his friend. So okay, fine, it's revealed later that he didn't do that, but actually since then he's done worse. So I don't know, I didn't really understand how the writers wanted us to feel about him. And that alongside a slightly flat kind of portrayal, I didn't really get it. But I think, you know, all a positive about the three protagonists, you know, Lucy, the ghoul, and Maximus, is that they do, like, between them kind of really reflect like a gaming attitude. Like, you can see yourself playing as one of them. And like sort of not having a strong moral code because you're just playing a game for fun. And like, and you're not really role playing.
Well, you probably have, like, you probably have every gamer in those three people. You have the gunslinger who just enjoys causing pain. You have Lucy who, I mean, I've done this myself. You know that one game you try and just do the right thing every part in the game. You just try and do the right thing, and then you have Maximus who is inconsistent. You take
a good and a bad playthrough.
You take a good decision, and then you have a bad day, so you take a bad one. You know, like I feel like those are the three types of players that play these. That play games. I didn't have any strong emotions towards Maximus. I felt like there was an opportunity for probably a better actor. To make you ignore those inconsistencies in the script. Like, I feel like if he had a little bit more conviction when he was playing the role, I feel like, you know, you might have been able to forget that. It looked like quite an early role for him, though.
Perhaps. I don't know.
Early role and potentially maybe quite a long career.
That's fair enough. I mean, it's kind of a minor criticism. Maybe it contributed towards me feeling a little bit like the plot was kind of all over the place. Like, it kind of does jump around. It's a bit of a mess. But then in that sense, it's very accurate to the game, the experience of the game. Like, you know, the sort of cutting in and out, and I don't know, as I said, I didn't play it, but but yeah, generally I think consensus across the board from critics, from the general public, is that this is great. Everyone's describing it as a blast and then saying, excuse the pun, and that's really tiresome.
That's a problem.
Although I kind of just have done it myself by bringing it up. But the one criticism that I did find that was consistent across reviews was the decision to drop it as a single piece rather than release an episode per week. Now, you know, this was in a review from The Guardian. It was hinted on the idea of dropping it all at once made it feel like one long movie rather than, you know, a TV series. Fair enough. But the actual place that this was most... heavily expressed was in our favourite critic's review of this game. Eric Kane, do you remember him?
Oh yeah.
From a few weeks back. What did he write on that he hated?
It was True Detective. Yeah.
Yeah, so this guy's back. He describes it as Amazon's blunder, and he talks about his problem with the show being that it will fade from the public conversation entirely and too soon because it's been dropped all at once. But if it had been dropped to like one episode per week, it would have dragged out the people's attention to the show, and ultimately meant that it would be remembered more. Now, in fairness to Eric, he does add later on, you know, on a personal note, I enjoy weekly releases more because I like writing weekly recap reviews, and he would rather talk about episodes individually. So he does admit a sort of bias, but I mean, what frustrates me about this criticism is it's not about storytelling.
Yeah, it's nothing to do with Fallout.
Yeah. If you had the self-restraint, you could watch it one episode a week yourself, even one episode a month. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's not really anything to do with you.
Mm. I will say, though, like, Amazon probably Amazon pick and choose which series they do this with.
Yeah.
And they maybe didn't back themselves with this one.
Yeah, fair.
Because they've backed themselves with, like, you know, things like The Boys, mm-hmm. rightly so. Mm-hmm. And they've backed themselves with... But they've backed themselves with things like Mr. and Mrs. Smith, which I don't think...
Was that one episode a week? Yeah.
I take his point a little bit, but he's just, I guess he's reaching for criticism. This is a person that likes to critique
work. Well, he claims, right? he doesn't like to.
He loves bashing on work, right?
Yeah.
And finding any way he can to stand out from the crowd, which is, you know, fair play to him.
Is it? I mean, you know, I definitely agree. I prefer when a TV series is released episode by episode, you know, on a weekly basis, because I guess I enjoy the sort of the weight and the sort of natural tension that brings, and you kind of savour it or enjoy it more, whatever. But I don't like the idea that makes it less memorable.
Mm.
It does if you consume it really quickly and then you move on from it. But ultimately, what should make a story memorable is the storytelling, the characters, the plot. You know, like, it should be able to stand the test of time based on its own merit rather than the way that the streaming platform chose to release it, you know. I don't see that as a valid criticism of the show or the writing or storytelling. But I got down a little bit of a rabbit hole with Eric Kane again. Did you know that the Silver Surfer has been recast? You hear about that?
I'm not really. I'm not interested.
Marvel Universal, I don't give a shit.
Really
either.
Not interested.
No, but it's been announced that Julia Garner will be playing the Silver Surfer in the next Fantastic Four movie. Who is she played Ruth Langmore in Ozark, if you've seen Ozark.
I started over Ozark, I haven't seen it.
Oh, stick with that, I promise.
Yeah.
It's gorgeous. It's so, so good. But obviously that's, you know, kicked up a fuss again because it's changed the gender or whatever. I don't know. I don't care. It's Marvel. Don't give a shit. But Eric Kane weighed in. I just love this line. I just scanned this article. You know, we were talking about him hating on female characters.
Yeah, go on.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so he's talking about how okay he is with the fact that the Silver Surfer has been regendered, and he literally uses these words. He says, I'm fine with a female Silver Surfer with her own backstory and identity. There are still plenty of dudes in this movie still. I mean, come on, man, like, just come out and say you want to watch a movie full of guys, it's cool, it's alright, no one's going to judge you for that. But I mean, there are still plenty. He's used the word "still" twice in a sentence unnecessarily, and this is a professional movie.
And this
critic.
Person's getting paid to do this.
I know.
Yeah, man. I think I've spent too much time with you because I used to really look forward to Marvel films, and now I'm in your boat where I'm not that bothered, and I'd rather they stopped, which is unfortunate for me. I used to really look forward to the next Marvel installment, but you've drained that out for me.
Well, I mean, that wasn't intentional, didn't we? I apologize.
The problem is we're reviewing all this, you know, all these great stories, and then you just see Marvel do the same thing over and over again, and now I'm here. I'm in the hater camp.
You're changing camp.
The criticism, the criticism I have is that the one thing I kind of hate about any show is when half an hour before the end you take a pill and it solves everything. And this cold fusion, like, I understood there was something in his neck that was going to be important, but I don't really understand why he had it in his neck. I saw him put it in his neck in the first episode, but I don't really understand why he knew that that was going to save humanity. I don't think him being a scientist gives, you know, a rebel scientist gives me the confidence to know that it will save the world if his head gets to this person. And I just don't think putting that little pill in a chain reactor has now saved the planet. I don't like that.
It's a bit cheap, isn't it? It's a bit of a cop-out.
With such a well-developed story, if you told me earlier on that that was the game, you know, if you told me at the start, this power could save humanity, but that was never really kind of coined anywhere throughout the show. So I have a problem with that, because I don't believe this is rushed. I don't believe this is rushed. But why have this oversight? You know, why have something that solves the problem so easily? And I know it was very hard to get the head to this group of people. But, like, in general, why is it that easy?
It's a plot device, isn't it? And I hear what you're saying. It's a little lazy. I guess they sort of didn't do the reveal of the cold fusion thing early because they wanted to... And they wanted the unknown. They wanted the ridiculousness of, you've got to get the scientist's head to these people.
Mm.
And of course, she doesn't actually care about the head. She's using it as an in to get to... Is it Moldova?
That's Moldova. A country. Yeah.
She wants to get after the person who's... She's looking for her dad. She wants to get after the person who's kidnapped him. And, like, her head is the way to do it, right? Funnily enough, I've just realised there, saying that it's actually really similar to The Last of Us. Because, of course, Joel has to transport Ellie across the country, but he doesn't actually care about Ellie. It's for something else, because he's trying to get a car battery or something. I guess similarities in
I understand that that is secondary to the experience. You know, it's a ridiculous point of the plot, but it's secondary to the actual point of the story. The point of the story is the journey
that these characters have to go through to get to. But I hear what you're saying, though. Like, the whole sort of, oh, and it's cold fusion in his head, and we can fix everything.
But what The Last of Us does differently with Ellie is, at the very start, that there's this, basically, there's a, you know, an interview with a scientist explaining what would happen if this fungus, you know, infected the world, blah blah blah. And you knew from the very start, and you know through, like, I guess, immunization science that if Ellie's immune, in theory, taking her DNA to someone that could fix it, like, you know that as a viewer anyway.
Yeah, you can piece that together for yourself.
You couldn't piece this yourself.
No, you couldn't, because it's ridiculous.
And you know, something subtle that was drip fed throughout the series, I think, probably wasn't that hard for them to do.
Yeah.
The funny thing I found with it, though, is the last half an hour is the start of a war to gain the power to rebuild humanity, which is the whole reason Cooper's wife and Vault-Tec made the decision to drop the bombs in the first place.
Yeah.
So it was just so, like, it's funny that, you know, they've gone through all this journey to get this head to Moldova, and the exact thing that, like, Vault-Tec were used capitalism to try and protect against, being war, happened immediately after the head was delivered to someone. Like, a war started immediately.
Yeah.
So it almost, like, proves the point that they did the right thing.
I mean, yes, yeah, an element of dramatic irony. And I like that theme, though. I like the sort of the whole, like, the reveal. I guess ultimately what I'm saying is, like, the present day story kind of took a backseat for me to the story being told in the flashback before the bombs are dropped.
Yeah.
Because that was so much more interesting, like the slow reveal that Vault-Tec were actually completely, like, corrupt and evil, and they were actually just going to drop the bombs themselves. They were like, we're actually going to drop the first bomb so we can sell this Vault technology and rebuild the world as ours. Yeah. I mean, like, the level of evil like, is crazy.
It's not that, it's his wife. It's the fact that it's his wife leading the charge.
And of course the reveal that it's Cooper's wife is, and you see it through him as well. You know, he discovers that, you know, this evil is in his wife. But I mean, that to me was a way more intriguing story than all this crap that was going on in the vaults.
Mm.
You know, like Lucy's brother, who's like slowly discovering that actually the vaults are all experiments or whatever. I mean, that's kind of cool, but to me, to be honest, it's too similar to Silo.
Yeah.
Remember Silo a while course. Back, and Silo did it better than the Soul Focus.
It's the first thing I thought of when this show started.
Yeah.
I'm glad you brought the Cooper Ghoul kind of storyline up, because. And I realise I quote this show quite a lot. The technique that they've used to tell his story, I saw it in Westworld about 7 years ago.
You know, it's the same producers.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. Westworld have done the producers. I've forgotten the bloody names. I'm sure you probably have them somewhere. But they did, the producers of the first series of Westworld did this, are responsible for this. So there might be
Oh my God, it all
you've,
just
you've
ties not, up.
You've noticed that without...
So,
yeah, fair play.
A technique in Westworld is where you're playing the same character's storyline simultaneously, and then, you know, character A and character B are the same person, but character A is good and character B is evil.
Mm.
And basically the end of the series is the point where character A becomes character B, turns evil. And in Westworld, they reveal that right at the end of the series. You're following this character that's experiencing the Westworld game, which is like basically the virtual reality Western world.
Uh-huh.
And he loves it so much, he kind of stays in the game, keeps playing the game. Simultaneously, because it is a virtual reality world, you have this evil character that lives in the game, that just basically ruins everything. And basically at the end of the series, it's revealed that character A, who's just starting the game, is exactly the same person as character B.
Right.
And that reveal was like shocking and everything. But Fallout did that the same. They were telling Cooper's storyline and the Ghoul storyline at the same time.
Yeah.
Yes, they told you that they were the same character earlier on.
Yeah.
But they were still using that technique of
yeah.
So what you're doing is you're wait. So actually, you know it's coming. You know there's a point where Cooper becomes the Ghoul.
Yeah, where the storylines collide.
Yeah,
exactly. It's like one's told from, you know, they're told towards each other.
Yeah,
you know,
and
back to front.
And it's a really, really intriguing way to tell the story. Now, I knew they were the same character because of the accent.
Yeah,
originally I was like, I'm sure that's the same person. But at episode 3, when he's about to do the advertise, Cooper's about to do the advertising for his wife.
Yeah.
It's at the end of the episode 3, and he does that. He's in the suit, and he does that.
Yeah.
But he does that just after the Ghouls shot the poster.
As soon as
Ella Purnell's looking at the Fallout poster, as she's being like, basically walked by a neck by the Ghoul, and she sees the Fallout poster with the thumbs up, I went, he's going to shoot that, isn't he? And then his face just disappears. And then they have that brilliant transition where you've got half the poster, which is Cooper, half of it's Cooper's face, and then half of it's the Pip Boy or whatever he's called, or whatever. Now, half of it's Cooper's face.
Oh, yeah, no, my
half
the poster.
And
because that's the real, I guess, that he actually is the model for the Pip Boy.
Like,
And
once you realise that, you're then waiting for that moment where those align, and it's basically when he finds out his wife is the head of
Vault-Tec, pretty much.
And it's a story. I'm very pleased that I recognised that was the method they were using, and I'm very pleased it's actually the same people that've done it.
you've definitely spotted like a signature technique there.
I have to say at this point, if you haven't at least seen Westworld season 1, to anyone listening, please just watch it. I don't know why I didn't commit to like the second season, but that first season in isolation, it's an amazing storytelling.
I've heard it goes off a cliff after season 1, but but yeah, I should give it a try myself for sure. I guess this one final minor criticism, maybe like very personal one, similar sort of gripe to the one that you had with the cold fusion kind of reveal. I don't like this use of like frozen chamber pods to bring people into the future. I think to me it's just a sci-fi trope.
We had it last week.
Exactly. You know, it's getting a little tiresome. It showed up in Three Body Problem, and you were talking about how difficult it's going to be to sort of like bring a lot of the characters 400 years into the future and then accurately portray the future. Well, of course, Fallout, the entire idea is it's
buds,
portrayal.
Buds.
What's that?
Well, that's what all the pods were. They were all the trainees that corporate guy in the suit.
Right, yeah.
The corporate guy in the suit froze all of these guys that he's delivered his business model to. So they can just keep it going in the future, isn't it? It's like, I believe capitalism could get there.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Where, like, you know, Rupert Murdoch or someone like that is so desperate to keep control over the media or a certain industry.
That he freezes himself.
He tells people what his idea is and then freezes them. And then every 50 years releases one that knows exactly what to do. Like, yeah. that is a reality. That is a scary potential reality.
It is mad. I mean, yeah, my point is Fallout is intentionally trying to portray the, you know, a hypothetical future.
Yeah.
Obviously an awful one.
Like, yeah.
And it does really play on a very sort of human, quite natural fear, doesn't it? And this use of sort of this cryogenic technology or whatever, you know, it keeps coming up, this whole idea of, like, bringing people into the future. It makes sense in Fallout because you sort of, you know, obviously you have to, I guess, have characters who were around from before the bombs drop, and then obviously 200 years in the future when, like, in the wastelands.
Mm.
But there's a lot of ways that the writers get around it. Obviously, the ghoul is 200 years old. How on earth did Cooper survive? You know, because he's a ghoul, and they apparently enough radiation exposure makes you live forever.
Yeah.
I don't. But you let it pass because obviously, like, it's a good story. It's fun ultimately,
yeah.
And that's really important. I think there's a lot to be said for the setting of Fallout as well. California. I don't believe that's the setting of the games. Because I know they did, like, a New Vegas spin-off later on. And, like, that was supposed to be a completely separate... Did it, really? That's supposed to be a whole separate spot.
No, sorry, Fallout 76 flopped. That was it.
Right. Well, California, you know, being as far west as you can get in the States, and this show being about the collapse of Western civilization and the potential to completely rebuild, and that seems to be a reoccurring theme in sci-fi and all of these apocalypse genres now. Again, Last of Us is a relevant comparison. How many sort of apocalyptic worlds or settings have we seen in the past couple of years? And all of them seem to have this undertone of, like, maybe this is a good thing because we need to rebuild society from the ground up. And of course, Fallout's explicit focus on Western society, I like the decision to say in California because of that.
Yeah. I'm not sure it is because of that.
No?
I think it's because it's convenient for it to be there.
Because, because maybe.
Cooper Howard's role as a 60s actor on those sets. They're Hollywood sets.
Yeah.
So it was just convenient to have that story.
But he's a cowboy as well, and it's like the old West, you know? And that, of course, that also... His role also kind of... Both as the ghoul and as the hero superstar, like in the 60s when he's a famous actor living in Hollywood, and the roles that he's playing, you know, these Clint Eastwood types, it all reinforces that idea of, like, independence and self-made man.
Yeah.
And,
but did Santa Monica Pier need to be in another series?
All right, fine. But you see my point, you know. Like,
I don't like Santa Monica, by the way. I'm just going to put that out there.
It's a good job they don't have a basketball team. But yeah, I mean, maybe I'm reaching, but I think that there was a focus on traditional American themes and the reconstruction of society being a positive thing, but still being built on the foundation of those traditional American values, you know? And I think that's becoming a thing, maybe I'm reaching a little bit too much or I'm not making sense, but I get the impression that more and more apocalypse scenarios are appearing in fiction and the concept of rebuilding is being pushed through.
Yeah. The ghoul at the dinner table being Lucy's mother was wild, though, at the end there.
Yeah, that was a bit gross.
That was too much.
That was a bit gross. I mean, I knew she was going to shoot her. Oh, yeah, that was fucking awful. I knew she was going to shoot her, and I'm kind of glad that she did. Brutal.